Derek Thirlwell, Reel One. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Sunderland, County Durham, in October 1919.
Did you grow up and have your education in Sunderland?
I grew up in Sunderland. I went to a boarding school in Lancashire, and I left at the age of 16 to become a training manager with Spillers Flour Mill in Sunderland.
Which boarding school was that?
At Rossall, just outside Blackpool.
What were you doing when war was declared?
I was still being a training manager with Spillers, and they believed in very much starting from the bottom, so I was filling sacks of flour and tying labels on it, and my wage was 11 and sixpence a week.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain's broadcast declaring war on Germany?
Yes, I did, and I was interested because by then I was in the Territorial Army with the Durham Light Infantry, and so I was very interested in whether there was going to be a war or not.
How did you feel about the war declaration?
Well, it sounds an awful thing to say, but for me it was so exciting and such a wonderful change from filling sacks of flowers that I rather enjoyed it. But I then realised that I would be happier in the Air Force because we were stationed in Kattrick and I could see the Spitfires and the Blennies flying from Kattrick Airfield, and I realised then that I was in the wrong department. So in those days you couldn't, a service could not poach from one to another, so the only way I could get into the Air Force was being seconded to Army Corporation, which I did. And so I went to Oldsale and the School of Army Corporation, starting on Hector's and then on to Lysander's.
Did you have any problems learning how to fly?
No, except I always remember, because I suppose being young and rather cocky, my instructor at Montrose, a flight sergeant, and I can say now that the flight sergeant pilots were the salt of the earth. They were the real backbone. And this particular trip, we got out of this Miles Master, walking back to the crew room, and I'm taking off my gauntlet gloves and the silk liners, and I said to this flight sergeant, "Well, flight, how did that go?" And he said, "Well, sir, if they're all the same as you, we might as well throw our bloody hands in now." Which was a great sort of, you know, put back. But I'm sure he was quite right.
And then, what was the next step?
Well, the next step was that I went to 225 Squadron on Salisbury Plain, and I was only there for 2 months, when I was posted to the Middle East, to 208 Squadron. And the first thing I recall was we had to report to HMS Foxland in Gourock, near Glasgow. And when we got there, I had a chap with me, Pilot Officer Atkinson, and we arrived and discovered that the Foxland was a destroyer. And the captain interviewed us and said, there would be no passengers on his ship, and therefore we were divided into two watches, which being two people made it quite easy.
So what date have we reached by the time you boarded the Foxhound? About.
It would be January 1942.
And before that, you hadn't seen any action?
No, none at all. And then...
But you'd flown Lysanders?
That's right. We flew them from Shoreham on Air Sea Rescue, and I actually saw a JU-88 shot down and went and dropped dinghies, life rafts for them. But I didn't see any crew. I think we went straight in with the aircraft. But the first action I saw was on the destroyer Foxhound going through the Bay of Biscay in December, where we actually sank a submarine. And I didn't realize then that in the past, the German U-boat crews would lie on the bottom, and then when they were depth charged, would let a whole lot of flotsam and jetsam up. And, you know, the Navy thought they'd destroyed a submarine, and they hadn't. And then, so at the time when this happened to me, when we were going through the Bay of Biscay, they had to actually produce bits of human flesh to, and I'll never forget this seaman with a boat hook hauling on board a whole chunk of somebody's body and bung it in a bucket. And this was proof that it had actually destroyed the submarine.
What did you see of the action against the submarine?
Well, we were in a convoy of, I think it was four destroyers and two cruisers, and it was depth charges which actually sank the subway. And then we arrived in Gibraltar, and we all thought we were going to go around the Cape, because they loaded the destroyers and the cruisers and with knee-deep or deck-deep in tires, engines, airframe parts, and all was labelled for Takoradi, so we assumed we were going to go around the Cape. And that evening we steamed out into the Atlantic, and as soon as it was dark we came back within the 3-mile limit on the African coast, and then took off for Malta. And I think I'm right in saying we were the first convoy with supplies for some considerable time. And when we arrived, there was an air raid going on at the time. And the jetty, which we were going to come alongside, suddenly disappeared in a cloud of smoke. And when we finally got tied up, the captain said, "Right," to Atkinson and me, he said, "I don't want to see you two till tomorrow morning." So we went off up to Valletta and found Valletta was deserted, and found a bar which was open and deserted. And then we stepped in the bar, and then the next morning went back to the Grand Harbour, and there was no Foxhound, which caused us great concern, until a sailor told us that Foxhound had gone around to Sliema and was refueling there. So we got on one of these horse-drawn buggy things, I forget the name of the bar, and went over to Sliema. And then we were told that we were not to go on the Foxhound, but onto the Arrow, another destroyer. And the thing which impressed me then was that the Foxhound was a very happy ship, and the Arrow had a different atmosphere entirely. And I think the captain was rather like the sort of Kane Mutiny business, because he used to rule by, I don't know whether it was fear or command or what. And I always remember we were approaching Benina, or Benghazi rather, and this boat fighter came out from the shore to look at us. And I was on the duty air crew recognition chap on the bridge at the time, and the captain And I asked him what it was. I said, it's a bowfighter, sir. And he immediately opened up with everything. And I protested. I said, sir, you know, this is a bowfighter. And he said, look, I have 146 men on this destroyer, and up there there are two. He said, they're not going to take any chances. And so we saw no more bowfighters or anything. And we arrived in Alexandria.
Oh, you didn't hit the bowfighter?
Oh, no, we didn't hit it. No, but the bowfighter very wisely returned to shore. And we arrived in Alexandria and went to a transit camp where the grapevine said the 208 Squadron of the Army, Operational Squadron, we were going to in the desert, was running through crews at the rate of the whole squadron in every 3 weeks. When the squadron leader turned up at the transit camp and asked if anybody was interested in PIU. And I said I was. And the next moment, I'm at Heliopolis and flying dark blue Hurricanes, taking photographs. And the officer's mess was more than full, and I was just told to go down into Heliopolis and find myself a billet, which I did. And then about 2 months later, they asked for volunteers for number 3 PIU in India, and I volunteered, and I had the splendid experience of going to Calcutta in an Imperial Airways flying boat as a passenger, which really impressed me. And I was very impressed with the captain, really was a captain, in that the luggage, the crew, the passengers went on board, then he would come out on the Nile at Cairo in his own pinnace, and he would get on board, and then he'd do the takeoff and the landing, and the same, the very naval idea, the captain was first off the boat, of the flying boat, and then everybody else followed. And when he was ashore, he was the senior Imperial Airways chap at the where we landed, and he would then carry out an inspection of the bedrooms, the accommodation, the kitchens, everything like that, and sign a report saying what he thought of it. And I was slightly dismayed when we landed on the Hooghly at Calcutta, because the first tender aboard, the Imperial Airways ground staff asked how many people he could evacuate. And I then went to Magway in Burma on a DC-2, an RAF DC-2, and I landed, and the station commander met the aircraft when a Hurricane, pouring smoke out, came zipping across the airfield and crashed. And the group captain said to me, well, he said, you're not needed now because that was the last PIU Hurricane we had. But he said, what I want you to do is go up to Lashio on the Chinese border and find out whether we can evacuate people through China National Airways. And I said, well, you know, sir, what do I do for transport? And he said, go and have a word with the flight sergeant in the orderly room. And this is the second day I was there, and the flight sergeant in the orderly room said, well, he said, I can give you a Woolsey 14, but he said, I'd like something in return. He said, do you know where there are any typewriters? I said, yes, as a matter of fact, in the house I'm billeted in, which had been evacuated, there's a dead typewriter on the desk. So he said, fine. So I swapped this typewriter for the Woolsey 14 and sent off at night to go to Lashio. And about 2 o'clock in the morning that first night, I realized that I didn't know whether I was going north or south, and therefore you know, I could be going entirely the wrong direction. But fortunately, when it came to dawn, and we were then at Michener, and all was okay. And I got to Lachelot.
Why did you not know whether it was north or south?
Well, because A, I hadn't got a compass, and B, it was at night, and it was strange roads, you know, it was, of course, I suppose I wasn't too bright in those days, and as I say, it came in the morning, and I was going in the right direction, got to Lachelot, and then...
This seems to be March 1942.
Yeah. And then I then was told to fly back to Calcutta, which I did. And then they realised that they were getting very short of Williamson's, these great big cameras for aerial photography.
Did you do any duties at Lachelot?
Apart from confirming that China National Airways could take evacuees, I didn't do. I just flew out from there back to Calcutta. They then realised they're getting short of these aerial cameras, and I was sent back to Burma to rescue some of the cameras, which I did.
And where then, from?
Bagui, basically, and. It might have been crashed, I forget the name of the place now. Anyhow, I was able to get some of these cameras back.
This was from crashed aircraft?
Yep. And then...
Can you give any details about getting the cameras from the crashed aircraft?
Not really. I just remember a couple of ground crew, and I told them what we wanted, and, we got them on a truck and got them back to Calcutta, to Dum Dum, on a DC-3, a Dakota then. And then I had the most extraordinary period staying in the Great Eastern Hotel, which is the five-star hotel in Calcutta. And I would go out in the morning to Dum Dum, get into my Hurricane, and fly to Chittagong, where I refueled with oil drums of petrol, petrol drums, and a hand pump, and the petrol was strained through a chamois leather. And then I would stay with the British consul that night, and most nights he used to have dinner parties, and it was not aware that the war was really going on. Then the next morning, I used to fly to photograph Rangoon or whatever place I'd been asked to take photographs, come back to Chittagong, refuel, and go straight back to Dum Dum to get the film back as quickly as possible. And then I would find myself showered and changed and having dinner in the Great Eastern Hotel with the bearers wearing their whites and white gloves. It was an extraordinary contrast. And then we graduated to B-25s from the Netherlands Air Force.
What are B-25s?
Well, B-25, that's its official description. It was known as the Mitchell to us. It was rather like a Boston bomber. And I arrived in Karachi to take over one of these B-25s, and the thing which really impressed me was the pilots of the Dutch Air Force. One I will also remember, Captain Vittart, and another one, Captain André de la Porte. And they were ex-KLM pilots, and Vittart had done 16,000 hours flying, and André de la Porte had done 14,000. And to me, I could not believe, you know, that people have that amount of experience. And they just treated aeroplanes as cars. I mean, they used to get in and go off. And to me, I was went with André Lauport from Brigload, Karachi, to Dum Dum Airfield, Calcutta. And I was the navigator. And I was so worried about getting everything wrong. And Andre de la Porte, you know, you couldn't see what the fuss was about. You know, just flying all the way from one side of India to another was perfectly normal for him. And when we arrived at Dundon, I was even more impressed because he feathered the starboard engine and beat the place up with the other edge. And then it was very interesting because the first thing we did was take all the armor plate and radios out of his aircraft to get in more fuel tanks to get the range which was required to get down to the Andaman Islands, for example. And I always remember the first completed B-25 was stripped of everything, and which we could strip out, you know, the radios, the armor plate, and all this kind of stuff. And then the problem was, how far and how high would this aircraft go? And I said cheerfully, well, let's go and have a look at Mount Everest, which Andre de la Porte thought was a grand idea. And we actually went out and flew over Everest, which was, in those days, you know, a great experience for me. And I then was checked out as a captain, and my first flight was to the Andaman Islands to photograph the dock activity there. And we took these photographs, turned around, and then I always remember he was the photographic airman, as you might say, who was in the back of the B-25, called L.A.C. Fox. And he went back to Cambridge after the war and wrote several books, and he was a very intelligent chap. But the first thing I knew was a boiled egg hitting the instrument panel. And I looked around, and here was Ellison Fox trying to attract my attention, because down below were two Lagan notes coming up to attack us. And
that's zeros.
What?
Zeros.
Yes, two zeros. And I can't recognize how I did it, but instead of trying to get more height, I stuck the nose down, and we got up enough speed to leave these Navy Nauts behind, because they're obviously out of endurance range. So I went back and handed it to Calcutta.
Would you have had any chance if the Zeros had caught up with you?
Oh, no chance at all. No, we would have been literally sitting ducks, because we had no armor plate. We had no defensive weaponry at all. So, and then we reached a stage where spare parts came into the battle, and trying to get spare parts for the B-25s was very difficult. And one particular thing were the tyres. And looking back, I can hardly believe it. We used to send the tyres down to some factory in Calcutta where they would vulcanize strips onto the tyre. So when you taxied along with these tyres, you could hear them going plonk, plonk, plonk on the runway. So then we were moved out to a place called Asansol, which was about 100 miles out of Calcutta. It was a mining district, as I recall, and it wasn't an airfield, it was just a great big long strip of flat earth, which is what we needed to save the tyres. And I always remember one vivid trip. We were going off to the Andaman Islands, and this time I was co-pilot to the flight commander, the flight lieutenant Frostick. And we were tanked up to the gills, and we'd only got airborne when the starboard engine burst into flames. And Frostick, without hesitation, chopped the other engine and ditched it in the Hooghly. There we were, one moment, taking off the Andaman Islands, and the next moment, we're in the river Hooghly, and covered in oil. And I got out, jumped over the wing, and to my astonishment, I was standing, because the river was so shallow. But it certainly achieved its object of putting the fire out, and so I suppose we were saved that way. I should say now that the CO of number 3 PIU was a wing commander, Fatty Pearson, and he was a terribly experienced pilot because he had been with Wilson Airways in Kenya, and so he'd built up, he'd been a short service commissioner in the RAF, finished his short service before the war, and went out to Wilson Airways, and he was again a most experienced carrier pilot. And he was then transferred to form a new transport squadron, 194 squadron, and he asked for me to go to him as a flight commander on 194 squadron. And I will always remember we went to the squadron formed as C flight of number 31 squadron in Lahore. And when we got enough crews, we became 194 squadron. But
this appears to be September 1942.
It would be, yeah. And then I will always remember my first flight in a DC-2 of 31 Squadron, flown by the commanding officer of 31 Squadron, Wilf Burbley. And he was the senior pilot of Tata Airways, so he was had a wealth of experience too. And his co-pilot was Fielden, the brother of Mouse Fielden, who was the Queen's or the King's flight in England, and he was a very experienced pilot as well. And I always remember the first takeoff we did from Lahore, and I was in the jump seat sitting behind them, or between them really, and Wilf Burbley got out his pipe, packed the tobacco in, lit it, and opened the side window and held it in the slipstream of it to get it going. I was still in the starry age of, you know, flying. It was a great excitement to me. And I could not believe that people could be so pedestrian in their approach to flying. And then we started on Hudson's. And I remember I was sent to Cairo West to connect to Hudson, which I'd never flown before. And the checkout, the conversion, was half an hour in a Lodestar. And then I was given a crew, and we set off going back to Karachi. And I will always remember landing in Bahrain in the navigator, who I'd only known for about a week. And he said, "Well, that's my 100th. And I couldn't work out what he meant. I said, "100th what?" He said, "My 100th hour of flight." I had cheerfully taken his instructions all the way across the desert to Iraq, Basra, and down to Bahrain, and little knowing that, you know, he was so inexperienced. And then we then started with the first Chinook program, and then we were also running mail runs around India, which particularly in the monsoon,